Welcome to Viva la Vulva, the podcast that explores and teaches about the goodness of the vulva. Here is your host, Dr. Kara Quant, an internal medicine doctor and advocate for female sexual health.
Hello, and welcome to the Viva la Vulva podcast. I am your host, Dr. Kara Quant, and I would like to thank you for joining me today on this solo episode. It has been a minute, let me tell you. It's been a minute of me not doing podcasting, not doing social media as much, taking care of myself and married life. And that's actually a part of the reason why I have not been recording recently, but I am back and I'm happy to be back. And I wanted to actually share with you this journey that my wife and I have been on of making a baby, because let me tell you, it is not like heterosexual couples. A same-sex couple, and this is women, obviously, which is different than men only making a baby. And so that would be a whole different podcast episode on that. But we are talking about, and this podcast episode is going to be entitled A Lesbian's Guide to Baby Making, because I want to tell everybody how this journey is going. And as a being a doctor, I did not realize all of the things that would be involved in even getting started to inseminate. It's a process. So I do want to go over it. And so if you are out there listening, wanting to make a baby, you're in a same-sex relationship, this is the podcast episode for you. And these tips and tricks and facts are things that I have learned on this journey of wanting to make a baby with my wife. So here we go. I also am going to have my wife join us on the, or join me on the podcast, after going over the basics, information about like how to even get started. But I do want to bring her in and, have her come in and talk about her experience in it, because it's, you know, it's two of us, and how she is doing with the process. So let's get started and get into it. So, we just got married about a year ago. Actually more than a year ago. We just celebrated our 1 year anniversary. Hey. And we have been, even before, actually after we got married, we started this journey. And it was pretty quick. It was a couple of months after we got married that we were like, okay, we are not getting any younger and we want to have a family. So let's do this. So the first thing was contacting my OBGYN and, you know, saying, hey, like, where do I get started? So my OBGYN was like, okay, the first thing that you need to do is an anti-Müllerian hormone test, which is also called an AMH. And that kind of tells the information about the reserve of your eggs. Some people have lower numbers than others. And so she was like, that is where you should start. I am 39, almost 40 years old. And so that was a big thing, because I am now a geriatric woman if I get pregnant, which is crazy. But you know, there's more things involved. There's more risks involved with having a baby as an older woman. So, the first thing was checked was an AMH. And my AMH was actually good. So that was like the starting point. I have good ovarian reserve. So that's nice. That was nice to hear. And so she sent me over to an, I would say a fertility, they're called infertility specialists, but I say fertility specialists. because I don't consider myself infertile. We have not tried. So infertility is actually defined as not being able to get pregnant for a year of trying. We have not been trying for a year. We've been trying for a couple months, and this is actually the beginning of it. So I call her my fertility specialist, but we were referred over to her, and she's been essentially ordering the tests for us that we need to do. And I say we because my wife and I want to get pregnant, but not at the same time. Not at the same time. There's many people, family members, friends that ask, oh, so are you guys going to get married or are you guys going to get pregnant together? And we're like, no, we're not about to get pregnant together. We want to take care of each other during each other's pregnancy. So I am going first. We have had a long discussion about it and she wants me to go first and I want to go first. So I am going first. But we did the AMH together and then we actually initially did the blood work together also. So what is involved in the blood work? So we met with our doctor, she ordered some tests and one of those tests included blood work. And it was a series of blood work, mainly basic labs, including a CBC, checking for your hemoglobin, checking your platelet count, and hemoglobin A1C, checking for diabetes or pre-diabetes, checking your vitamin D levels, checking your blood type, which I've never actually had before. So it was basic tests that were tested. Hormone levels also. So prolactin was checked, FSH or follicle stimulating hormone, TSH or the thyroid stimulating hormone, estradiol level was checked. And then STI testing. So HIV, syphilis, hepatitis C, and actually really important one called CMV or cytomegalovirus. And that is actually going to become important when we talk about the sperm donors. So keep in mind that, but CMV. Also, feel free to just side note, feel free to take notes or refer back to this because it is pretty involved. And like I said, I did not understand the complexity of it before starting, which was probably a good thing. So those were the basic labs that were checked for us. Then we actually did pelvic ultrasound. So ultrasound of the pelvis, including the ovaries and the uterus, to check for fibroids, to check to see for ovarian cysts, and just to check the just our anatomy. And an HSG was also done called the hysterosalpingogram. And so that is a procedure that involves putting some dye inside the uterus and looking at the fallopian tubes to make sure that the fallopian tubes are open. There are certain things that can, certain diseases and processes that can affect the fallopian tubes, including STIs that have been untreated, like chlamydia and gonorrhea. So HSG was done. It was a little on the uncomfortable side, but it wasn't too bad. It lasted, I don't know, like 5 minutes. It was a pretty easy procedure. Ultrasound was also pretty easy, and blood work was, you know, blood work. So that was that in terms of the like pre-testing, what we needed to do just to make sure that we are capable of having a baby. And then our next step was a meeting with a genetic counselor. And doing some testing for that, which I also remember doing or remember reading some stuff about, you know, what would be required in this journey. And genetic counseling and testing was one of them. And so during this genetic consultation with the counselor, we talked about our family tree, you know, mom, dad, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, anyone who had any inheritable diseases like breast cancer or had the BRCA gene or had, you know, sickle cell anemia trait or cystic fibrosis. So those are inheritable diseases that can be passed on from one person or one generation to the next. And so we did a basic family tree with a genetic counselor. And so because I am in a certain medical system, there was some basic tests that were ordered. So we had checked for cystic fibrosis. We have checked for sickle cell trait. And that was like the basics of the genetic testing within the health system that I'm in. But I came to find out that there was more testing that needed to be done. And the reason how I found that out is because when we started looking for sperm donors, when we initially had our consultation with the genetic counselor, they were saying that we would be good with the testing that was already done. So we're like, okay, good. That's fine. You know, we're taking the advice of the experts, because even as a doctor, I am not an expert in this field. So what advice I would give, and if I could do this journey again, I would do it a little bit differently. And so when we had the genetic testing, and they checked for, I don't know, two or three pretty common genetic diseases. But when we have to be compatible with the sperm donor, it was found out that we should have been tested for more genes. And so we usually cryobanks, when they have sperm donors, the cryobanks test for 300 or more genes. And again, my health system only checked for about three. So that did come into account again when we were looking for sperm donors. So I would recommend going to other genetic testing sites, which are online, and there's a good amount of them. The ones that we were sent to were Invitae. There's something else called Sema4, and there's other, you know, if you just look up genetic testing, there's a lot of sites that are out there. But Invitae is the one that we went through and that was recommended by the genetic counselor. And so through that, we were able to test for more genes. And I think it was like 300 genes that I eventually tested for. And so that moves us to the sperm donor. So we talked about the testing before even starting the process of insemination, and we're still not at insemination. So we talked about the blood work, talked about the ultrasound, the hysterosalpingogram, the genetic counselor, and then moving to the sperm donor. So this has also been a journey in itself of looking for a sperm donor. We came to find out that there's over 200 cryobanks in the U.S. And cryobanks are places where sperm donors, you know, give sperm, and they are in these banks. Over 20 cryobanks in the U.S. And I was just doing some research and actually talking with other friends who were on the journey of wanting to get pregnant. And when I was doing research in 2022, there were 12 African American donors available from the top four cryobanks. 54 Hispanic donors were available from these four top cryobanks, which is crazy because I am Black. My wife is Mexican. We want to have a baby that looks like us. And we were essentially wanting to look for a Black and Mexican sperm donor, which we came to find out very quickly that it was a pretty low chance of finding someone like that. These are obviously anonymous donors. They're not people that we know. And I actually will give a, I will give a little story about the people that a person that we were put in contact with who was Black and Mexican and was willing to donate. So I'll give you that information in just a second. But so 20 cryobanks, there are not a lot of Black and Mexican donors that are out there, which is pretty disheartening. And, you know, after doing a lot of research, going out to different cryobanks, these cryobanks are also not cheap. You have to pay for membership. You know, they have like a monthly membership, or you could do like 3 month membership. And then it's essentially like a dating app or a dating website. So you go on, you sign up for a membership. You see pictures mainly of their, their baby pictures. And then sometimes those sites do have more pictures of them. So maybe 10, 15, 20 pictures of them. But sometimes those pictures are the cost. So you have to pay for, in order to see the pictures of them in different stages of their life. So not just as a baby, but, you know, as a teenager or actually as an adult. So there's a lot of upselling that happens on these websites, which we came to find out very quickly. On top of there not being that many African American and Latinx donors. And then the other thing that you have to think of when you are looking for sperm donors is that not every sperm donor that you find that looks good is going to be compatible with you. And so that's what we found out. So that's where I, that's where CMV comes back into play. So that cytomegalovirus that was tested early on is also tested in the sperm donors. And you should be compatible. So if you have CMV or if you've been exposed to CMV and you're CMV positive, then your sperm donor needs to be CMV positive also. I am CMV negative, and so my sperm donor has to be negative also. So there are some really good candidates that we liked, and they looked good, and they had a good background, and they looked good on paper, and they had a good height. Which is definitely, you know, you have to take into account. But they were CMV positive. So that was a little disheartening also. So, you know, as you kind of filter, because you can filter for CMV, you can filter for height, you can filter for ethnicity. Once you get, you know, you put all those filters in place, the numbers get down sometimes to zero. Sometimes they don't have any donors that meet those criteria. And so we have, that probably took the most amount of time, is looking for a sperm donor or sperm donors. Because once you do the insemination, sometimes the sperm donor doesn't, that particular sperm donor doesn't take. What also was helpful, advice from friends of ours was you have to make sure that the sperm donor has had pregnancies in the past, because even if everything has been tested, their sperm has been tested, they've been tested for STIs, including CMV, they've done the genetic testing, as long as if they've not gotten someone pregnant, it could be that their sperm doesn't work, or there might be something wrong with the sperm. So that is something else that you have to take into account. So in our lull, in our time of, you know, figuring this all out and feeling like we didn't have very many options, we met with some friends of ours, and we're talking about our process, and they're like, oh, you know, we know a Black and Mexican donor, and he lives in Mexico City. And maybe we can set up something where you guys can talk, and like, maybe he would be interested in donating. And so we're like, oh my God, yes, it sounds perfect. Like, this sounds absolutely great. So we schedule a Zoom call with this guy. And he's on board. He's excited. He's like, he's had kids before. He doesn't want any more kids. He doesn't want kids anymore. But he is definitely open to donating to us. But the concern is that we would have to pay for everything moving forward. So for him to be tested, for him to be STI tested, genetic tested. And then we also didn't think of the legal aspect of it. And, you know, maybe not everyone thinks about this, or like, not everyone takes this into account. And I have heard people who had friends and gotten pregnant with friends, or, you know, friends of friends. But there's a legal aspect to it. Do you want this person who's just donated to you to give, are they giving their right to not see this kid, you know, at all, ever? Or like, is there like, you know, what is the legal bind that you guys have created in moving forward after donating? So the reason why the cryobanks are good and many people go through with it is because they've already done the legal stuff for you. They've already done the genetic testing for you. They've already done the STI testing for you. They've gotten bios and information from them. They've interviewed them. You can hear their voice. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that they put forward to these sperm donors to make it a success, to make it as easy as possible for women to get pregnant who either their partners can't have children for whatever reason, or it's a same-sex couple. You know, there's so many different styles, and I mean, there's so many different reasons why people would need to go to a cryobank, and it makes it very easy. And we were thinking that, you know, well, a known donor is what they're called. A known donor that we know or that we've been introduced to can, you know, be just as good. But we came to find out that it's not as easy as we thought. He still needs to be tested. And what if we spend this money and he's CMV positive? Or if we spend this money and, you know, he has a genetic, he's a genetic carrier for something that I also have. And so that increases our probability of having a baby with this genetic mutation. So there were so many things that we had to think about, even though this person was so good, that we had to think about to actually be inseminated. And so we didn't go with a known donor because we felt like it would be too complex. So we ended up going the cryobank route. So let's see, let me look at my notes because there's so much information and I wanted to get like everything in. Okay, so we talked about the sperm donor, and that probably took a couple months for us to actually find a good sperm donor. And this was also during the time that that I am being genetic tested. So that takes 4 to 6 weeks. You know, I have to send a swab, a saliva swab to this facility that tests. It usually takes about 4 to 6 weeks to process and for my results to come back. So again, a lot of these sperm donors are contingent on what my genetic testing is and what my CMV status is and also what their ethnicity is and so forth. And if they've been, if they've gotten someone pregnant, before. So that is that. Yes. So now that that's all done, so we've done the blood work, we've done the ultrasounds, we've done the genetic testing, we found the sperm donors, multiple. Now it was time to be inseminated. So I'm like, oh, this will be easy. It's just, you know, insemination. It's called IUI. And so, you know, we have to, you know, we're busy people, so we have to make an appointment for testing, for insemination. And so there, at the beginning of my period is kind of when things start. So they calculate, I mean, essentially from when your period starts to ovulation, it's about 2 weeks. So you have about a 2 week time frame to get everything going, get your body prepared for, releasing of an egg and hopefully, you know, an insemination, and hopefully like fertilization of the egg. So in order for the body to prepare, they, the fertility doctors usually give some medicine. So, started from, so this kind of timeline starts from the first day of my period. They brought me in for an ultrasound. So the ultrasound looked to see, my ovaries, looked to see the follicles that were growing, and looked to see what side was good, if there was a good amount of follicles during the cycle. So there were follicles. So they gave me, getting closer to ovulation, a medicine called letrozole. So letrozole, it has different uses. It's considered an aromatase inhibitor. So it essentially suppresses estrogen production. And if anyone has seen the menstrual cycle, where it shows the different hormones and their, you know, their fluctuations, including estrogen and progesterone and FSH and LH. I mean, if you've ever seen that cycle or that diagram, it's actually really helpful when talking about this. But and I actually even had to reference it. But letrozole is the aromatase inhibitor that suppresses estrogen production. And so if you've ever looked at the cycle, estrogen kind of drops off pretty quickly, like right after ovulation. So it's essentially helping with ovulation and helping with the egg being released from the ovary. Or at least preparing the eggs for release. And then right a couple days before insemination, another medicine called Ovadril was given. So this is actually self-administration. My wife did it. But it's usually called the trigger shot. So it's essentially the... the medicine that causes the ovaries to release the egg. So gave that injection, and then a couple days later, usually 24 to 48 hours later, insemination can happen. So you know, we have to call the cryobank. The cryobank has to, you know, we pay for the sperm, and that's also another actually big thing that I didn't really talk about. Sperm vials cost a good amount. It's anywhere from, I would say, probably $800 to about $1,500 per vial. So each vial you need for each insemination. And there are some people that I know that have gotten pregnant off the first or the second insemination, but there's also some people that usually take 6 or 7 or 8 or 10 inseminations for them to get pregnant. So it's costly. So again, it's about $800 to like $1,500 per vial. So we call the cryobank days before, we paid the money, and then we got our tank. We got our tank. 20, they can usually do it pretty quickly. So it's, you know, they can overnight it, or if you have a little bit more time, they can ship according to your schedule. So we got the big cryobank tank, and we had to take it over to our doctor's office for insemination day morning. And so the morning was pretty, so the first time we did it, we got the tank, we took it to the office, we checked in, and we kind of waited around for our doctor to do the insemination. And you know, they have to prepare it, so they have to send the vial to their lab. I think that they look at it under the microscope to make sure that the sperm are viable, that they're moving around. They usually have to thaw out the sperm. So it's a process. It's not just like, you know, you take it out the tank and you suck it up and then inject it. It takes some time. So I think that was probably 30 minutes to an hour. They wanted me to drink a lot of water to make sure that my bladder was full for an easier insemination. So it's thawed out. They look at it under the microscope. The sperm are viable. So it's a go. And so during the insemination, it's pretty easy. I mean, your legs are in the stirrups. It's almost like a pap smear. There's very little pain, but they do go past the cervix into the uterus to inject the sperm. It's not just at the opening, or not the opening of the cervix. It's actually through it. So there's like minor cramping, but it's not too bad. And then they let you sit for about 10-15 minutes. But I think that our issue, and what I want to do again, because we've now done it twice, and we haven't gotten pregnant yet, but you know, I'm still very hopeful. We've only done it twice. And so people have said to lay down for 30 minutes, or like 20 to 30 minutes. Some people say up to an hour. I don't know if there's any necessary science behind it, but next time we do it, I'll be laying down for 30 minutes and just taking it easy. So that is the process. That is the process that we have gone through thus far. The first time I did it, it's about 2 weeks later that you are you have a serum HCG test, where you know, do a blood test to see if you're pregnant or not, and that is usually the first thing that can detect that you're pregnant. So, you know, no drinking during that time, usually taking it pretty easy. I worked out the next couple of days after the insemination, and I felt pretty good. I mean, there was, you know, it was, I felt normal. I felt like nothing really had happened. So we took our test, the serum HCG, 2 weeks later. The first time I didn't know about acupuncture, but I'd heard about it. So the second time that we did this process of the insemination and, you know, the medicines beforehand, I did acupuncture before that. So I've heard acupuncture and other friends of mine who've gotten pregnant with acupuncture and also doing insemination. I wanted to give it a go. So started maybe a couple weeks before we were going to inseminate, and then went until we did the blood test a couple weeks later. So it was about a month long. And so that is where we are at so far. And I now want to bring in my wife and just have her talk about her journey. I mean, she's had to do some of the testing before also. And so how she feels about this process. So let me bring her in. Hello and welcome back. As I said, I was going to bring my wife on to give her thoughts and opinion about this whole process that we've been going through. So welcome, Eliana, to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I had some questions for you, mainly around like thoughts and feelings around what has been going on. So my first question is, what were your initial thoughts when we first discussed starting a family together?
Of course, I felt excited, especially doing it with a partner so loving and nurturing as you are.
Oh, stop.
Obviously, I've always wanted to have a family. And yeah, I've just been excited by the idea of doing it with Kara.
Okay. And then how did family and or family, especially, but also friends of yours, how did they react to you sharing the plans of starting a family together, especially as a same-sex couple?
I think everybody's been eager for us to get started and supportive. And, you know, I think I was like the first of my friend group to get married and do the whole shebang. So I think everybody's just like eagerly awaiting.
Including your mom, right?
Including my mom. She's been waiting for a while.
Yeah. Including actually both of our parents. My mom and dad are here. And so, yeah, they are both anticipating having grandchildren or grandchild.
Yeah.
So they're, yeah, definitely excited about the process also. Mm-hmm. My mom always asks, she's like, oh, so what's going on with, you know, what's going on? Have you guys been inseminated again yet? Or yeah. So she's been asking a lot about it. And inquisitive. I feel like a lot of people have just been like generally inquisitive about us and our process, because it's not usual, right?
Yeah. I guess I'd never really expected it would be like this, but it's been a journey for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Speaking of journeys, can you describe the emotional roller coaster you've experienced during this process? What are some of the highs and the lows of this experience so far?
It's been a roller coaster for sure. I think in the beginning, it felt super optimistic and positive. I think we were like, okay, we're going to go do our tests. Everything was good. We did the HSG, like a lot of blood tests and ultrasound. And it just felt positive. It felt like we got this. And we were met with our first set of challenges where, you know, finding the perfect donor, making sure that we were compatible with them through like genetics and like, what was the other thing that we have to be like negative?
Oh, CMV.
CMV negative. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's already so limited for Black and Brown donors. So it's like you have this pool that's already limited, and then it becomes more limited by this like factor of CMV negative. And then again, it's more limited by this, like, obviously the genetic factors that we have to make sure we are compatible with them. So it's definitely been, yeah, a challenge to find the right donor. And then feel connected to them by like finding features, you know, like we're only allowed to see the child photos. So it's like, okay, this donor kind of looks like me, or, you know, or we find another donor, it's like, maybe I can see myself in that donor. But yeah, so I think we finally found the right donor, and then we went to go get the sperm, and it was sold out.
Sold out, yes. After we did all the genetic testing, and we were like, okay, it's ready, we're good from our end. And then, yeah, we went online, and it was gone. It was, the one that we really liked was gone.
Yeah. So then we had to get on the waiting list and find another perfect donor, and which we did. We found another donor and we were super excited. We got started, we made it. And then, you know, of course we didn't get pregnant. So I think definitely coming, like, it was a high getting there, and then it was like, okay, kind of back to reality. Feeling like, okay, like this is a defeat, but we can get back on the horse and we can try it again. And I think in every round, we've like learned a little more and realized like, oh, next time we're going to do it this way, or we're going to be more prepared with this. And Kara started doing acupuncture, which I think really helped.
Because it helped a friend of hers to get pregnant.
Yeah.
And also a friend of your friend's.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So we went for the second round, and she was ready in the ultrasound, like in the, which she wasn't the last time. So I think
my follicles were like big, they were juicy, they were definitely ready to pop, to like go out into the fallopian tube.
So we kind of had to like scramble and like order the specimen or overnight. And I kind of feel like that was the reason why we did, like, because they had to hold her egg in place with hormones, right?
They did, yeah. I had to do a shot to like hold the egg before I did the trigger injection. To drop the egg, yeah.
So next time we're going to have the sperm ordered and ready when we go to the ultrasound, because I do feel like the acupuncture does some magic.
It has been helping, yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah. And I want to say a bit or circulate to what you said earlier when you talked about you also did testing, and the reason why you did testing too was because you want to get pregnant also, but just not at the same time.
No,
which is a common question that we get asked.
Probably the most common.
It's actually the most common question that we get asked.
Are you going to do it at the same time? It sounds crazy.
It sounds really crazy. Like, I don't want to have pregnant bellies in bed like together. Mm. We already take up a lot of space, and to have like two pregnant bellies.
I also want to take care of you and dote on you and be there, you know, holding your hand through the delivery and just be present. And I just don't think that would be possible if I was like ready to pop too.
We would have hormones surging everywhere. It would not be good. So, but that is probably the common question that we get from family and friends. If we're going to have a baby together. And the answer is no, definitely not. Yeah. Definitely not. But I did want to ask you, because you are also going through the process. We initially went through the process together of blood work and ultrasound and HSG. Like, how do you feel about getting pregnant?
Some days I think, yes, I do want to get pregnant. And other days I'm like, do I really want to get pregnant? Do I really want to go through all that? I feel like we kind of been conditioned to like always say, like, think and want, like, desire the, like, you know, to give birth. And I think there's moments where I definitely feel that, but I think probably there's like a lot of fears for me of like going through that process. And like, maybe it's just like, I'm a control freak and like surrendering sounds like so scary sometimes. So I think what I've kind of decided is that I'm going to go through it with you and see if I feel comfortable to, but I'm also like totally fine if Kara is the only one that made the child. Like, yeah, I think there's a lot of people around me and us that want me to have a kid, but I'm going to be probably 42 when we even attempt to start my journey. So it's just, if it's not in the cards, it's not in the cards. And if it is, it will happen.
Yeah.
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 So. But you do have to, and the doctor has said this, but getting started at some point with, I mean, they recommended to us doing embryo freezing. So yeah. Taking the egg and, you know, putting it with the sperm and freezing that rather than just egg alone.
But we'll see how much that costs, because that might be pretty expensive.
Yeah. And cost is definitely a factor. Like, you know, luckily we have insurance, and that insurance covers part. I think I said earlier, 50% of it is covered, but not 100%. So there's still, you know, money coming out of our pocket in this process, during this journey.
Yeah.
And I think I also quoted on the earlier on the podcast about like how much it is for the vials.
Yeah.
And I said anywhere between like $800 to $900 and like $1,300 per vial, and each vial you use with an insemination. So however many inseminations you do, that's how many vials you get.
Yeah. So a vial, let's say like average is like $1,000, and then you have to ship it, and it's probably going to be overnight. So that's like another $250, and one of the sperm banks we use actually charged a tank fee, like a cryo tank fee. So that was $800. So it's like all these little things add up. And then I think like every time we go to the doctor to do the insemination and the ultrasounds, probably like another $500, right?
Probably about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Going back, the tank fee is just like it will be reimbursed to you once you return the tank.
Yeah, but like,
but you still have to put that money. It's definitely unexpected. Yes, it's definitely unexpected.
Well, actually, Seattle sperm bank didn't require that tank fee, which I was like surprised about. But yeah, I mean, you're still like, I'm sure they'd probably charge it if you didn't ever like return the tank. But yeah, I was like shipping it back
immediately. Yeah, like right after the application.
Any surprise?
No late fees. No nothing. Yeah. We're about to return this immediately after we use it. Yeah. So it can definitely be a costly process.
Yes,
for sure.
Yes.
I wanted to go over like how, in your opinion, how has our relationship evolved during this experience, and anything that's been unexpected for you? And besides what you said earlier about like the highs and, you know, the lows of it taking a while, you know, us doing the insemination and the genetic testing, which took a while, but like what in terms of our relationship has evolved.
I mean, I feel if anything, it's made us stronger. Because, you know, like learning about ourselves in the process, learning about how to support each other in the process, like dealing with like disappointment and, you know, obstacles that are kind of like out of our control. I think like it's all been a learning process and like just strengthening our bond. And of course, like dealing with all of the lows it's easier to do together.
Yeah.
And then we get to really celebrate the highs, which is awesome too. Mm-hmm. So like, I feel like it's just been a lot of learning. And I think that realizing about myself, which maybe I already knew, like I'm more reactive in the moment and Kara's like very calm and composed. She doesn't like immediately react. So I think there's been like some moments where like I was just like, you know, frustrated, and she's definitely taught me to like surrender to the process and just leave it to the universe. And yeah, so.
Yeah. It is, yeah, it's definitely a process. And I know people who've gone through lots of processes, whether it's, you know, a year of trying to get pregnant before they got pregnant, or like many years, like they're, yeah. And I think that there is, you know, definitely fear involved, or fear can be consuming. But we actually just had a tarot card reading, and like the baby is there, the baby is, you know, gonna happen. It's just a matter of allowing for everything to be done in divine timing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Perfect timing.
Yes. And lastly, because we have gained so much information from this process thus far, what advice would you give to other lesbian couples who are considering starting a family or going through the same process that we are?
I would say get started early, earlier, the better, because there's going to be so many unexpected twists and turns along the way. I feel like the genetic testing is like huge to me. Like obviously the HSG and the blood tests and the ultrasound, those are like high priority. But like, if you're going to go on to these donor sites and like start searching for your perfect donor, I think knowing, you know, if you're CMV negative or CMV positive, and if what your, you know, genetic
carrier screening is,
yeah, is like huge, because I mean, you'll basically eliminate half the pile with that criteria. So, I mean, I think like, yeah, doing all that those tests sooner than later. And then if you have the ability to purchase, you know, some vials up front and just store them, like I would do that, because
especially if you really like the donor.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, we got fortunate that the donor that we originally chose was had another release, but it could have been that they didn't and we wouldn't have been able to get the donor. So I think if you have the ability to start early with that as well, and I guess just surrender. It's not easy, but like just be in the moment with your partner and treasure all those moments that you have together before your world changes, because it's going to be so different. I mean, we don't even know what it's going to be like, but we're not there yet.
But we have many friends who have kids and they're all like, oh my God, I barely get like 5 hours of sleep.
Yeah.
So yes, I am surrendering, and I also like really enjoying this time of sleep, being able to sleep in late, like all of that.
Doing as we please.
Doing as traveling.
We love to travel.
Yes.
Just living life.
Living the fullest. Yes. Until that day comes when we find out that we're pregnant and when we deliver and the first couple months of having a newborn and all of those great things that we have ahead.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything else that you want to add? I feel like that was pretty good, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this has been a deep dive into baby making for lesbian couples. Or if you're not in a relationship, if you're just a single woman, you still need to probably go through this process. Of having a baby, of starting a family. So if you have any questions, please email at vivalavulvala.org. I don't even remember my email. Or you can go onto social media at Dr. Kara Quant or Viva La Vulva LA. Again, this is not a, this is for entertainment purposes only. If you are going through this process, you need to be seen by a doctor who can give you more specific information for yourself. So this is for entertainment purposes. And that is all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.